Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/chocolate. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3. Give it a taste at audibletrial.com/chocolate. When I first told people I wanted to create a show about chocolate, most of them thought I was crazy. Typically, I'd get, "You mean like recipes? You know I don't like to cook," I'd respond. "Then what? What's there to know?" Now, that's an interesting question. I would have asked the same not too long ago. But after spending the last 5 years not only eating chocolate, but traveling to the places where it grows, meeting the incredible people farming, studying, transporting, selling, and making it, and working on a book about it, I have to say, the answer is a lot. I'm Simran Sethi, and this is The Slow Melt, a podcast about chocolate. Why is it called the slow melt? Because melting is what happens through human contact. Chocolate is a substance of connection. It's my every birthday cake. It was my wedding cake. Chocolate helped me get through my divorce. I sat in a tiny studio apartment in West Harlem and fed my broken soul chocolate. That connection has lasted longer than any job and almost every relationship. But despite this, I couldn't have identified chocolate in nature. I had no idea where it really came from. And I didn't know anything about the lives of farmers who grew it or the makers who transformed it. Now I do, and I want to share this with you. I want you to meet and learn from the people who have taught me, because what I've learned has made me appreciate chocolate even more than I already did. Every episode in this first season is designed to help you enjoy chocolate all the more. We're going to meet farmers and makers, plus chefs, chemists, tasting experts, conservationists, and many others who will all, in their own special ways, help us deepen our understanding of chocolate. So, first things first, what is chocolate? Chocolate comes from a pod called cacao that kind of looks like a ridged honeydew melon or American football. It's not coca. That's the plant that becomes cocaine. The cacao pods come in colors ranging from yellow and green to orange and deep purple. And we eat the seeds that, once processed, become cocoa and chocolate. And that chocolate isn't just one thing. Chocolate is multiple. There's so much to learn about this sweet stuff many of us take for granted. So today, we're going to look at multiple aspects that shape how and why we love chocolate. First, we'll explore the diversity in the crop. Then, the different aromas that affect its flavor. And finally, we'll talk about how we can enjoy this diversity on our own.
It's associated to happiness. I know that it's also very good. We tend to want chocolate when we're sad, when we're stressed. It's associated to a lot of emotions, I think, and that's why we're so attached to this product.
That's Bridget LaLiberté. She's a scientist at Bioversity International, a research organization based in Rome, Italy. She focuses on conservation and diversity in agriculture.
So I specialize in cocoa since about 6 years, and I've been working in crop diversity for about 20 years.
Bridget is one of the people on the front lines, trying to save diverse varieties of cacao. But diversity isn't just in the genetics of the fruit. It's also in its terroir, those variations in the soil, microclimates, and the areas where cacao is processed. It's a taste of place, something we talk a lot about in wine, but can exist in nearly all foods if we let it.
The product of chocolate, of course, is the result of very well-made craftsmanship chocolate and recipes and savoir-faire and so on. But the cacao, the cocoa behind, has a lot of diversity, has as much diversity as if you think of a wine, of a grape, of coffee. More and more people realize that there's a lot of diversity in coffee. Maybe 30 years ago, coffee was just a brown liquid that you that you boiled and you drank. And it's, I think it's the same thing with chocolate. We have, maybe we did have a tendency, not everywhere. I think in Europe, there's been a realization of this a longer time, maybe than some other countries, but it's much more than a brown, sweet, exciting product to eat. There's a lot behind the crop in terms of flavor potential, in terms of quality. You do have a lot of diversity in flavors from cocos that will taste like dried raisins, to some that would have a tint of tobacco, to some that would taste like an orange flower, and so on. And some would just give you this really, really, really rich chocolate flavor that we know and love and look for in our chocolate.
Okay, the rich chocolate flavor is obvious, but tobacco and orange flower in chocolate? Yep. And those flavors aren't add-ons. They come from the bean and the way those beans are processed. A series of studies led by Darren Suka at the Cocoa Research Center found that floral flavors in cocoa were largely a reflection of the genetics of the plant, while fruity flavors varied from place to place and seemed to be influenced by processing. We'll do a deep dive on where flavor comes from in a later episode. A cocoa bean is about the size of an almond. It's made up of a nib that's about 50% fat. And that fat, also known as cocoa butter, is incredible because it holds all the aromas Bridget was talking about. They're the dominant part of flavor and the research focus for Peter Schieberle, a professor of food chemistry at the Technical University of Munich in Germany. Most of what we call flavor comes from smell. So I called Peter to get a better understanding of what aromas make chocolate, chocolate.
I do flavor research since 81. So you can imagine it's a lot of work we did on different foods, not only on chocolate. But chocolate is really fascinating because at least you can eat, well, you can say as much as you want. On the other hand, I know it's a kind of joke. It makes your clothes shrink. You understand this joke?
I do. I do. I live this joke. Always just for research, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Our brain is only able to compare an odor to something which we have smelled before. So if you have smelled, let's say, the nice cake baked by your grandmother, you will never forget this aroma. But you always compare everything you smell to something you have in your brain as a profile.
So what Peter is saying is that we can only identify what we already know.
Everybody can smell orange juice. If you have smelled orange juice before, you smell it, it smells like orange juice. Or if you smell chocolate, then you exactly know it's chocolate. Of course, different varieties, but you can clearly say it's chocolate. It's no beer.
The common wisdom has been that the more airborne or volatile compounds a substance has, the more diverse the flavor.
So over the, let's say, the last 100 years, people were of the opinion that all volatile compounds, which you can find in a food or in a raw material, contribute to its flavor. And so the idea we follow is that a flavor compound can only be a flavor compound if the concentration is high enough to generate a signal at our odorant receptors in the human nose.
This is an important shift. A lot of people I've spoken to have given the terms flavor, aroma, and volatile equal importance, assuming all of these compounds made chocolate more delicious. What Peter and his colleagues have found is that just a small fraction of aroma or flavor compounds actually bring the magic.
So by applying certain methods, we can find out that for a chocolate, you have only 30 to 35 real aroma or flavor compounds. So you need these 35 compounds in a certain concentration to make the typical flavor of chocolate.
The aromas Peter is talking about aren't what you'd expect. He and his colleagues discovered that the main aroma compounds that come together to create the smell that we recognize as chocolate come from substances that, when isolated, smell like cabbage, potato chips, popcorn, peaches, raw beef fat, soil, and human sweat, among others. So, of course, my question was, how on earth did they manage to figure this out?
We have a set of human odorant receptors, which are expressed in cells, in cell systems. And so we offer every single aroma compound we have detected in the chocolate, offer these single components to the receptors. And then we can see out of the 420 receptors a human being has, which one is responding. Then we add the other one and the next one and so on. And so then we have the step between the receptors and the human brain.
In other words, the work was painstaking, and it's still evolving. But what we do know about our sense of smell is that our smell receptors send signals to multiple parts of the brain, many of which are part of the limbic system. That's responsible for our emotional responses and the formation of memories. Many of us have eaten chocolate for a long time. The smell of it reinforces our appreciation, and it also triggers something deep. So how does that connection affect our relationship with chocolate?
So I'm Igrani Yu. I'm the author of The Chocolate Tasting Kit and a Vancouver, Canada-based chocolate educator and freelance writer and editor.
So if you had to synthesize the very first steps to understanding chocolate and those diverse flavors, what would they be?
The first thing that I say to people is, you know what, if you're interested in good chocolate and in fine chocolate, one of the easiest things to do is just go out and taste. You know, buy a couple of bars, and I understand that, you know, they can be on the pricey side. So this is a time where getting your friends together is fantastic because it's a social thing and you can all talk about it and learn together. And I think most people find that after a while you start to have the inventory to be able to have some sort of foundation to be able to say, I like this, I don't like this, or I can compare it to X or I can compare it to Y.
Okay, what else?
In addition to tasting a lot, I encourage people to make notes. So I've got notebooks where I will just write down a couple of words for each bar. And in my case, it's tasting notes. But if you were just starting, you could note texture, for example. Oh, it has a really creamy melt. I find that sensations, as I call them, are easier to describe. So astringency, like, does this chocolate leave my mouth feeling dry? Is it acidic? Does it make my mouth water when I have it? What's the finish like? After it's melted, is it still going, or is it kind of like short and quick and done? And these are some really easy things that people can kind of observe as they're just getting started. And once you make enough notes and you taste enough chocolate, you start to notice things and you start to, that light bulb starts to click. You start to connect all of these ideas and start to have enough of a foundation to be able to take that chocolate to the next level and specifically to kind of know what you like and what you don't like. So I've mentioned fruity chocolate, for example, like chocolate from Madagascar or made with beans from Madagascar tend to be on the fruity side. And often new tasters will start there, partly because it's easy to find and partly because it's so different. You know, if you're eating 99-cent bars or even, you know, like a Lindt bar, for example, and you taste a bar from Madagascar, like a Kraft chocolate bar from Madagascar, the fruitiness of it really blows people away. And so that can be a really great place to start. But some people don't like fruit in their chocolate. Some people like a chocolatier chocolate. And so when you start to taste enough chocolates, then you start to figure that out for yourself. And I find that to be the divider. Like some people love the fruit and some people really don't. And once you figure out what you like, then you can kind of take it wherever you want to go. So if you like the fruit, you can find more fruit. If you don't like it, then you know that you can find more nutty or roasty or whatever, you know, flavor profiles do appeal to you.
As you're talking about something like fruitiness or nuttiness, what you're also really pointing to is being able to find your words, like articulate what you're experiencing.
it's hugely important. That was actually where the kit came from. I was doing these tastings and I was really finding that people didn't have trouble tasting anything, but they had trouble attaching a word to it. So in other words, connecting tongue to brain. And if you can't talk about something, then you can't have a conversation about it. So you and I could sit down and taste the same chocolate. And once you get past yummy or delicious or, ooh, it's really melty. I mean, that's a very basic kind of conversation. And it just really felt like vocabulary was missing. And so I wanted a way that gave people an idea of words that were possible with the hope that when you saw that word, you could just say yes or no. So is it fruity? Yes or no. And then if it's not, you just disregard it. And so you could host a chocolate tasting party with people who had never tasted chocolate before, and you could have a conversation about it. And so you could talk about, well, this chocolate was earthy and this one was fruity, and I like the fruity because. And once you can start actually articulating what it is you like about chocolate or don't like about chocolate, then you have the tools to go online or to go into a specialty shop and explain.
What's so interesting to me about this common language is that it's the starting point to exploration, but it's also the memory of things that we've tasted and smelled before, like Peter was talking about.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's so interesting to see people when they have the vocabulary, how much more confident they are in tasting. If you don't feel like you have the ability to describe what it is you're experiencing, people are often afraid of making mistakes, I find. And they, at the beginning of a tasting, people are very quiet, they're quite timid. And by the end of it, you know, when you do have that vocabulary, people are grabbing at the cards like, hey, let me see that one. I think it's this. I think it's this. And it's exciting to be able to taste something and say, hey, this tastes like blah.
But smell language isn't something we're all well versed in.
When I was working on the kit and I was trying to figure out what words do you include in there, I was doing really conscious tasting. So it sounds ridiculous, but I would, you know, sit down and eat a raspberry. What does a raspberry taste like? Well, it's actually kind of floral. It's sweet. It's acidic. It's fruity. It's got raspberry-ness is actually quite complex. And to try to get all those things consciously into my brain, this is what a raspberry tastes like. So that the next time that I tasted it, I could say that is a raspberry. And it goes both ways. When somebody says to you, hey, do you taste this? You know, maybe it's a little bit of the power of suggestion, but, you know, often people are like, oh yeah, I do taste that now. And I think it just, you know, it makes it a richer experience. And as you say, it, even if your definition of what this word is differs, in principle, there's enough continuity there that you can still connect over that chocolate. And frankly, even if you disagree, I think that having a vocabulary opens the door to much more in-depth conversations than are possible otherwise.
Exactly. Okay, so what else?
So I really encourage people to taste openly, but also to taste confidently. And by that, I mean to have confidence in what you like and what you don't like. And, you know, if you taste something and you disagree with whatever the pundits are saying, that's fine. That, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
There you have it. Chocolate is multiple. And how to partake of its multitudes. Be open to diversity in cocoa and chocolate, as Bridget explained. Keep an open mind and be confident, as Igrani tells us. And one more thing from Peter.
It's much better if you let the chocolate melt in your mouth. Don't bite and swallow directly. Melt in your mouth, masticate it, and you will feel, and you can do it tonight if you have chocolate at home, you feel that the flavor gets more and more intense. And this is a liberation from a natural precursor. So if you just bite and swallow, there is no time for this chemical reaction. So recommendation is eat slowly.
Allow it to melt, the slow melt.
Yes, yes. Melt and really masticate it. So use a lot of saliva at least to generate these compounds. So I called it in-mouth chemistry.
I can get behind that science.
So what does this chemistry and heightened awareness do? According to Bridget, it brings us closer to where it all begins.
I think that we're at a very, very interesting time for cocoa and chocolate. The awareness of its diversity, the interest of the consumers to want to taste different things, I think is really, really coming to a boiling point at the moment, where we see a lot of diversity in origins of chocolates, even at the supermarket. It's accessible, it's affordable, and it tells the story. It's starting to tell the story that there's a lot behind chocolate that has to do with its base ingredient, that's way beyond rewarding just the chocolate maker and the pâtissier or those very skilled people. There's a base product behind that deserves to be recognized, that is a noble product that has required a lot of skills to grow in very hard conditions, very tough conditions. And I think if it should increase our pleasure and not necessarily make us feel guilty, because there are people behind who depend on it for their living.
There's no guilt here. And we'll learn a lot more about the people behind chocolate in the months ahead. This has been the first episode of The Slow Melt. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends and also rate and review us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. We're The Slow Melt on Twitter and on Instagram. If you have feedback or show suggestions, send us a note through theslowmelt.com. Please join me again just before Valentine's Day for an episode called Be Still My Heart. We'll learn how to pick out the very best chocolates for our beloveds and also explore the ways in which chocolate makes our hearts quicken and forges intimacy.
There's something unusual about chocolate that allows that intimacy to be experienced. So it's a type of a food that you will have a smell, you will be able to look at it a certain way, you can feel it in your mouth and on your fingers a certain way. So it really touches all the senses.
The Slow Melt is written by me, Simran Sethi. It's edited by Jason Sloat, who also created our fantastic soundtrack, and made all the better with production help from Katie Ranke. Special thanks to Sasha Woodruff for editorial guidance, Aubrey Lindley for moral support, and Kim Hawley for design of our website and logo. And of course, my greatest thanks to you. This podcast episode was sponsored by Audible. You can get a free 30-day trial and free audiobook of your choice by going to audibletrial.com/chocolate.